Robert Mugabe, Zimbabwe's president who just won re-election last month, June 27, continues to be loudly condemned for conditions in his country. In September of last year, Mr. Mugabe came to speak at the United Nations here in New York, portions of which you'll hear. But first, in the interest of context, we'll show you excerpts of early Like It Is programs that documented some of Zimbabwe's long struggle against the brutality of colonial rule. All that after this.
South African style, controlling the politics and the economy totally. Whites in Zimbabwe enjoy one of the highest standards of living on earth. Africans, however, can only live in specific areas of their own country. Those who want to visit or seek employment in urban areas must carry passes. Pay for Africans averages a tenth that of Europeans. The rich and productive land has been apportioned so that Europeans average 160 acres a person. Africans get 7 acres a person on the average. For hundreds of years, a great African kingdom flourished in parts of what are now Mozambique and Zimbabwe. Weakened by internal forces and conflict with the invading Portuguese, the Monomotapa Empire collapsed in the middle of the 19th century. Succeeding African realms were confronted constantly with European encroachments on their land. Finally, at the Berlin Conference of 1884, European powers agreed on how they would divide Africa's land and peoples. Subsequently, Cecil John Rhodes, a British financier and imperialist who dreamed of establishing a sphere of British domination from South Africa to Egypt, negotiated a deal for minerals with Lobengula, the king of the Dembele in what is now Zimbabwe. Almost immediately, Rhodes violated that deal by passing his own laws and creating his own police force, as well as trying to enact a government. The Africans then repudiated the agreement and found themselves facing not only Rhodes, but also the British Empire, which granted Rhodes a charter to rule this African land for 10 years. Africans resisted, but they were eventually defeated by superior weapons and reinforcements rushed from Britain and South Africa. Eventually, the land now called Rhodesia was established as a self-governing colony. This meant that although the European settlers would rule, Britain could, in theory, intervene to protect the rights of the African majority. The end of the Second World War saw the beginning of a second wave of European immigration into Zimbabwe. Three-quarters of the present population of whites has settled in this country since 1946. By 1953, Zimbabwe, or Southern Rhodesia as it was then called, was united with Northern Rhodesia and Nyasaland in a federation. Resistance to European domination continued, however, leading to the breakup of that federation. Northern Rhodesia became Zambia, Nyasaland became Malawi, Zimbabwe continued under European settler domination. Africans continued to struggle for their liberation. In response, the European settler regime intensified its repression. Zimbabwean nationalist parties were banned and their leaders arrested and detained for as long as 10 years. Ian Smith, who became prime minister, led the white minority to a unilateral declaration of independence from Britain, this on November 11, 1965.
The British government has allowed our case to deteriorate into this fantastic position, almost comical.
Even Britain, the colonial power, joined in an international condemnation of the Smith action as illegal. The Smith regime has never been accorded international recognition. Escalating guerrilla warfare has alarmed the European population as well as the governments of South Africa, Britain, and the United States. And most of Zimbabwe is now a war zone. Whites are under siege, causing them to barricade their homes. Some are leaving the country. For the first time in Zimbabwe's history, more Europeans are leaving than are arriving. The United States and Great Britain have escalated their efforts to reach a settlement before the Zimbabwean guerrillas enter the capital as a victorious Liberation Army. Meanwhile, Smith's army has increased its repression against innocent African civilians, killing some and forcing others into barbed wire encampments, which the white minority regime calls protected villages. A serious cause for alarm to Ian Smith is the Alliance of Zimbabwean Liberation Movements that was entered into in 1976, called the Patriotic Front of Zimbabwe. The potential of this political and military alliance has caused the illegal Smith government to modify its posture and seek accommodation. They led a delegation to the United States to accept a new seat in the United Nations General Assembly for an independent Zimbabwe. His first stop was Harlem.
This invitation has made it possible for me to express to the people of Harlem and to the whole Afro-American community, indeed, to all the progressive forces in the United States, Zimbabwe's most profound gratitude for the support, material, political, and moral, given us during the bitter years of our protracted armed revolutionary struggle. We took to arms. We took to arms and challenged the white man to defend his fascism. We challenged him to defend his illegality. We challenged him to defend his racism and rampant barbarity. But we, you and I, we fought in the name of non-racialism, justice, legality and equality. The white man fought in defense of 250,000 white people. We fought in defense of all our 7.5 million people. And we fought in his own defense as well. And the hope of all the Zimbabweans that our independence has brought the decolonization and independence process to the doors of South Africa and Namibia. Indeed, as Nkrumah once said, Zimbabwe, like Ghana, and indeed the whole of Africa, will never rest until every square inch of our African territory has been freed.
Then on August 26th, Zimbabwe was fully installed as the 153rd member of the United Nations General Assembly.
I therefore declare the Republic of Zimbabwe admitted to membership in the United Nations. I request the Chief of Protocol to escort the delegation of Zimbabwe to its place in the General Assembly Hall.
Before Prime Minister Mugabe left New York, Lycidas had the opportunity to talk with him. We asked him what else he hoped to accomplish in his trip.
Other purpose is to enable me to meet the President of the United States and discuss matters of common interest with him, one of which is the question of United States aid to Zimbabwe, and another, the policy of the United States on the remaining areas of colonialism in Southern Africa, South Africa in particular, and Namibia. What is the United States doing about the furtherance of the process to majority rule and democracy in those areas?
In view of the fact that this is an election year here in the United States, might this not be a bad time to have such talks with the president?
I don't know whether the environment is conducive to the United States giving us more aid. They have given us some aid already, But we believe the United States has the necessary resources, adequate resources, to enable it to give us more aid. We couldn't have done it otherwise. We have to be admitted this year as a member at the United Nations, and naturally I had to come and lead the delegation for that purpose. And in the context of that, we felt it was necessary for us also to have some discussions.
How much aid have you received, has Zimbabwe received from the United States?
I think the United States is giving us some $50 million for a start, $25 million of which is an outright grant, and the other is a soft loan.
A soft loan. Where does that figure rest within your preferences?
Well, the aid will really be used for purposes of development in the agricultural sector mainly, but also for the resettlement of our people who were displaced during the war. The process is one. The people who were displaced need land, and that land is going to be apportioned to them on a systematic basis, such as would ensure that the land is developed and utilized for purposes of increasing the production of certain basic commodities.
But what sort of figure would you seek in excess of 50 million?
We do not really suggest any figures where we are asking for aid. We leave it to the possible donor to determine how much they are able to give us. But in the light, of course, of our objectives and programs, which we can spell out to them.
You mentioned the refugees, and most of the world was quite concerned about the condition under which the refugees had to exist, many of whom fled to Mozambique and other frontline nations. How has the process of restoring them to their homes and their property proceeded?
The process started before the elections, and we got the assistance of the UNHCR and various other United Nations agencies where they could give us support. They also extended some help. Then within the country, church bodies and other voluntary organizations worked alongside the UNHCR.
Have all the refugees been returned to Zimbabwe?
All of them are back home.
All of them.
And what is needed now is to move them from the temporary areas of accommodation to permanent areas where they can be resettled, but purposefully resettled, so they are able to have some source of existence.
As a member of the front, you must have considered the possibility that someday you might be head of state. Is the realities of that office anything like what you were thinking about in those days before?
Well, I never really, worked to become head of state or become prime minister, but the possibility was always there since I was the president of my party. Nevertheless, what we have achieved is a constitution which has established a system where you have a nominal or ceremonial head called the president, more or less a British type of political setup, and then you have, of course, the prime minister, who is the effective governmental head, and this is what I am. The process, naturally, is an ongoing one. We hope that in due course we could work out a constitutional position or modification of the constitution, which will enable us to have an executive president.
It was such a long and bitter, protracted struggle. What about hard feelings? Have they been mended, or how is that process going?
We have done our best to try and mend the bitterness and the feelings of the past, to transform the situation of war into one of peace. And this is why we adopted, immediately we became the government of the day, the theme of reconciliation, which demanded of us all the need and requirement to forgive and forget, to turn our enemies into our friends and allies, so we could work together in consolidating our independence and transforming the country for the good of everybody. That we should forget the past, submerge the ethnic differences which exist, and try to project our oneness and a single nationality and loyalty to the Republic of Zimbabwe.
How is that process coming along?
Well, it's succeeding tremendously. I think we have achieved a good deal of success. It is, of course, not possible to have 100% success. Individuals take time to transform. There are those, and I'm quite sure these constitute only a fraction, who have not yet adjusted. But I think the bulk of them have adjusted, and quite a good percentage of the whites have placed their loyalty to the government and are prepared to work under it, alongside the Africans, and transform the country for the benefit of everybody.
We heard, though, that there were many who expected that the reapportionment of land would have been brought about more speedily. What is your response to that alleged dissatisfaction?
I don't think it's true that our people are dissatisfied with the pace at which we are going in allocating the land. The land is being allocated. Whatever we managed to get initially is now being allocated to them in those areas where this land is available. But more land is being allocated. I think the most urgent need we felt was to get people at least back to their original areas, and after that proceed to undertake the second phase of the program, which is to allocate them land. After all, the farming season is really in November, and we still have a couple months to go before the critical period has been reached. So I'm surprised that there is this information, which I think is really not true, that the people are dissatisfied at the pace.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that we were aware of and made aware of when the struggle was still underway was the vast disproportion of land that Europeans held, the best land in Zimbabwe, and the people indigenous to the land had small parcels of land and the worst parcels of land. Now, if that is so, I guess my question is, has that been reversed?
No, it hasn't been reversed completely, but the process to reverse that is underway. It is true that the whites had half the total area of the land, and of course, when you talk of their having half, you're talking of a population of hardly a quarter million having half the land, and not all that population anyway is a farming community. Only about 6,000 farmers, you see, use the land. And this is the reason for the disproportion that existed. Uh-huh. Now, we are reversing that. We cannot, of course, accept a position where land is divided on racial basis, mm-hmm. and where the division works out an injustice to the majority of the people.
We understood that Ian Smith held a tract of land that was almost analogous to the size of Harlem here in New York City. Has any of his land been reduced?
No, but we have asked that all land which is not being utilized or which is owned by absentee owners, the multinationals and other landlords in Britain and elsewhere, that land should revert to the state so it can be redistributed to the people. The process of undertaking that task is one under the Ministry of Lands, and just now they're working out the modalities of bringing about the necessary equitable distribution.
In Zimbabwe, is that true?
I wouldn't want to call it scant. There is always, there is already quite some substantial investment by Western private establishments.
Which?
Union Carbide here is one such, Anglo-American is another, Lonro, and you have several others. And just now there is quite some pressure on us to open the way for many more institutions to establish themselves. Mm-hmm. However, the prospective investors would want to be satisfied that first the political atmosphere is conducive to that investment. Secondly, that when investment is made, dividends and profits will be easily remitted abroad. And thirdly, that in the event of repatriation of capital, it will be permissible for them to repatriate it. Mm-hmm. Our attitude is positive on all those aspects, but naturally would want to ensure one that when investment comes, it comes in areas we regard as crucial, areas which we cannot operate on our own, either as the people of Zimbabwe in the private sector, mm-hmm. or as the people of Zimbabwe in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And secondly, that some measure of private, of local participation must be acceptable to outside investment. In other words, if a multinational would want to invest, we would now insist that some percentage of the equity must be local.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage might that be?
Well, no, we are not suggesting any definite percentage, but we would want to leave it for now to the particular enterprises to determine what percentage. But we would want to see a gradual localization of that investment.
Is this a modification of your reported philosophy of government? When you were engaged in struggle, you were described by the international press as a Marxist. Now, is this philosophy that you've expressed of business a modification, if that description was adequate or accurate?
No, it isn't really. Yes, we are of Marxist persuasion, but we have said that our Marxist principles must take into account the environment in which they are to be applied, the historical, traditional, and in our case, even Christian realities that we have to grapple with. And that there's got to be some accommodation of the basic principles people have utilized as basis of creating their own society. We have said, therefore, that we cannot proceed to destroy the economic infrastructure we have found. Nationalization would amount to a complete overthrow of this existing system.
So your approach to achieving socialism is a gradual one?
I think for a beginning it's bound to be gradual, because the problem of consolidating independence is paramount in our minds. You have to ensure that at this stage all the forces that are agreed upon the whole question of democracy and the need to consolidate independence combine, and naturally ideologies may differ, but at least commitment to the consolidation of independence is the same. But of course, there are areas where it is possible, with immediate effect, to bring about some form of socialism. And this is in the agricultural sector, which in respect of land, where we have the bulk of our people, close on to 5.5 million to 6 million of our people, and the total population is 7, live in rural areas. Now, we will collectivize their agriculture, where, again, the people themselves are willing to come into collectives. In the private sector of secondary sector, where we are concerned about the position of the worker, we would want to develop the worker and ensure that his role is effective. First, he must be organized, and secondly, his conditions of service must be fair and just, and thirdly, his level of skills have got to be developed. That is fundamental, and it's basic to any socialization any government might want to desire to embark on in this sector tomorrow.
Is unemployment high?
Yes, it's very high indeed, very high, especially as a result of many kids being thrown out of school with school facilities running short during the war and no development taking place. And hence, there is quite a high rate of unemployment. But we want to...
what would you say it is, Mr. Prime Minister?
Pardon?
What would the rate be?
I can't say. One has got to have some population census before one can actually say what number of people are unemployed. But it's quite a large population without jobs. We want to try and alleviate the problem by getting many of them onto the land and then getting the youngsters to school, those of them up to the age of 16 or so must necessarily get to some kind of school. If we were able to do that, then we could move quite a number of them of the people from the streets and be able to now grapple with the problem of finding jobs for those who are mature enough in society.
In the broad sweep of the continent of Africa and liberation, what is next on the agenda? Is it South Africa itself, or is it now Namibia?
I think Namibia is on the agenda. Namibia should probably have got its independence before us. Let it not be forgotten that it was after the First World War a mandated territory, and then became, after the formation of the United Nations, a trust territory. And there is no reason why a trust territory should have had its independence delayed until now. In the case of colonies, of course, you had definite resistance being shown by the colonial power. But in the case of trust territories under the United Nations, we really do not appreciate the fact that Namibia is not yet independent, merely because South Africa has shown quite some irregular form of resistance, completely illegitimate. It cannot be the legal authority over Namibia, and we blame it upon not just South Africa, but on the Western powers.
Are you saying then that Western powers should exact more severe
yes,
sanctions?
They must. They certainly have to exert pressures on South Africa. And I cannot see South Africa resisting these pressures. In any case, the people of Namibia are waging an armed struggle, and I cannot therefore appreciate a position where the Western powers would want to see more people die before independence is granted, when the road to independence is quite clear.
How would you answer those in this country who say that to exact sanctions, economic sanctions, would only hurt the labor force of Africans, in South Africa and Namibia.
Well, it may be true, but if that kind of pressure is not acceptable to them, then they must use other forms of pressures, and they are immense forms of pressures which the United States, America, United States, Britain, the West Germany, France, and all countries which are associated closely with South Africa can exert upon it.
Do you still hold an avenue open that a solution can come about through negotiation, or do you feel that the same solution that was required in Zimbabwe will have to be exacted in Namibia and South Africa?
There is already a raging war which SWAPO is waging against South Africa, and one naturally cannot ignore the need for a political solution at the end. I think SWAPO just now is amenable to suggestion or proposals for a conference with South Africa.
That the Security Council as presently constituted is not democratic. In its present configuration, the Council has shown that it is not in a position to protect the weaker states who find themselves at loggerheads with a marauding superpower. Most importantly, justice demands that any Security Council reform redresses the fact that Africa is the only continent without a permanent seat and veto power in the Security Council. Africa's demands are known and enunciated in the Ezulwini consensus. Mr. President, we further call for the United Nations system to refrain from interfering in matters that are clearly the domain of member states and are not a threat to international peace and security. Development at country level should continue to be country-led and not subject to the whims and caprices of powerful donor states. Mr. President, Zimbabwe won its independence on the 18th of April in 1980. After a protracted struggle, protracted war against British colonial imperialism, which denied its people human rights and democracy. That colonial system, which suppressed and oppressed us, enjoyed the support of many countries of the West who were signatories to the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Even after 1945, it would appear that the Berlin Conference of 1884, through which Africa was parceled to colonial European powers, remained stronger than the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It is therefore clear that for the West, vested economic interests, racial and ethnocentric considerations proved stronger than their adherence to principles of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. The West still negates our sovereignties by way of control of our resources, in the process making us mere chattels in our own lands, mere minders of its transnational interests. In my own country and other sister states in Southern Africa, the most visible form of this colonial control has been overland, despoiled from us at the onset of British colonialism. That control largely persists, although it stands firmly challenged in Zimbabwe, thereby triggering the current standoff between us and Britain, supported by her cousin states, most notably the United States and Australia. Mr. Bush, Mr. Blair, and now Mr. Brown's sense of human rights precludes our people's right to their God-given resources, which in their view must be controlled by their kith and kin. I am termed dictator, and yesterday
You heard Mr. Bush here calling my government the Mugabe regime, because I have rejected this supremacist view and frustrated the neocolonialists in their endeavors to keep us as slaves in our own country. Mr. President, clearly the history of the struggle for our own national and people's rights is unknown to the President of the United States of America. He thinks the Declaration of Human Rights starts with his last term in office. He thinks he can introduce to us, who bore the brunt of the struggle for the freedoms of our peoples, the virtues of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What rank hypocrisy. Mr. President, I spent 11 precious years of my life in the jail of a white Englishman whose freedom and well-being I assured and protected from the first day of Zimbabwe's independence, and that was Ian Smith. I lost a further 15 years fighting white injustice in my country. Ian Smith was responsible for the death of well over 50,000 of my people. I bear scars of his tyranny, which Britain and America condoned. I meet his victims every day, yet he walks free today. He farms freely, has a farm of over 500 hectares. He talks freely, associates freely under our black government. We taught him democracy. We gave him back his humanity. He would have faced a different fate here and in Europe, if the 50,000 he killed had been Europeans. Africa has not called for a Nuremberg trial against the white world, which committed heinous crimes against its own humanity. It has not hunted perpetrators of this genocide, many of whom live to this day, nor has it got reparations from those who offended against it. Instead, it is Africa which is in the dock. It is Mugabe and not the British Prime Minister who is in the dock, facing trial from the same world that persecuted us for centuries. Let him realize that both personally and in his representative capacity, as the current President of the United States, he stands for this civilization which occupied, which colonized, which incarcerated, which killed. He has much to atone for and very little to lecture us on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. His hands drip with innocent blood of many nationalities, and today with the blood of the Iraqis. But he still kills. He kills in Iraq, he kills in Afghanistan, and this is supposed to be our master on human rights. He imprisons and tortures at Guantanamo. He imprisoned and tortures at Abu Ghraib. He has secret torture chambers in Europe. Yes, he imprisons even here in the United States, with his jails today carrying more blacks than his universities can ever enroll. He even suspends the provisions of the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. Take Guantanamo, for example. At that concentration camp, international law does not apply. The national laws of the people there do not apply. Laws of the United States of America do not apply. Only Bush's law applies. Can the international community accept being lectured by this man on the provisions of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights? Definitely not. Mr. President, We are alarmed that under his leadership, basic rights of his own people and those of the rest of the world have summarily been rolled back. America is primarily responsible for rewriting core tenets of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. We seem all guilty for 9/11. Mr. Bush thinks he stands above all structures of governance, whether national or international. At home, he apparently does not need the Congress. He defies it. Abroad, he does not need the United Nations. He does not need international law and opinion. I'll go, he said, to Iraq with or without the United Nations. That is, with or without international law, in defiance of it. This forum did not sanction Blair and Bush's misadventures in Iraq. Did we say yes to it? Did we say yes to the attack of Iraq? The two rode roughshod over the United Nations and international opinion. Almighty Bush, perhaps some might regard him as their God. No, he's not my God. I have but one God. He is in heaven. Pater Noster, qui es in celis. Indeed, he wants us to pray him. We say no to him and encourage him to get out of Iraq. Indeed, he should mend his ways before he clambers up the pulpit to deliver pieties of democracy. Is he qualified to speak of democracy? Is he qualified to speak of human rights when he's shedding blood every day? Mr. President, the British and Americans have gone on a relentless campaign of destabilizing and vilifying my country. They have sponsored surrogate forces to challenge lawful authority in my country. They seek regime change. They seek regime change. Not my people, but they think they are entitled to change governments, placing themselves in the role of the Zimbabwean people, in whose collective will democracy places the right to define and change regimes. And they want to talk of democracy when they are behaving that way. Let these sinister governments be told here and now that Zimbabwe will not allow a regime change authored by outsiders. We do not interfere with their own systems in America and Britain, where they steal elections as he did during his first election. We do not interfere. Mr. Bush and Mr. Brown have no role to play in our own national affairs. They are outsiders and mischievous outsiders and should therefore keep out. The colonial sun set a long time ago in Africa, in 1980 in the case of Zimbabwe, and hence Zimbabwe will never be a colony again, never ever. We do not deserve sanctions. We are Zimbabweans and we know how to deal with our own problems. We have done so in the past, well before Bush and Brown were known politically. We have our own regional and continental organizations and communities. In that vein, I wish to express my country's gratitude to President Thabo Mbeki of South Africa, who on behalf of SADC, the Southern African Development Community, successfully facilitated the dialogue between the ruling party, my ruling party, and the opposition parties, which yielded the agreement that has now resulted in the constitutional provisions being finally adopted. The amendments to the constitution, which both parties agreed to, and which paved the way to the elections for which our various parties are now campaigning. Consequently, we will be holding multiple democratic elections in March 2008. Indeed, we have always had timeous general and presidential elections since our independence. Mr. President, we want to be left alone.